But then when I was in eighth grade, I became more interested in orthodoxy, and my parents were largely drawn behind in my wake. My father started wearing the yarmulke after I did, so, and he worked in a public high school in Queens, so that's no small thing, you know, just one day to show up at work wearing a yarmulke.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. It's interesting to me to think about how my personal religious traditions and attitudes were given to me. You'd think that going to church almost every week of my life for years was where I would get most of my religious training, but I think most of that was actually details, maybe learning some doctrine, or here is how we do this aspect of our worship when we all meet together, even the way to conduct a meeting or teach a class. But I think most of what I would really call my faith happened in my family, like inspirational stories that my grandmothers would share about them, about my grandfathers or other family members, and how God had helped them in difficult situations. Hearing them tell those stories with absolute faith that God was involved in their lives made me willing to act in faith, even when I didn't know for sure the next step on my path. So for all the good that attending church does, the stories that made me feel like I was a believer almost all happened at home. Today is the last of our three-part mini-series on faith and family, and our guest is Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, with an MS in education, an educator whose experience in Jewish outreach and informal education spans four decades. Rabbi Jack has served in several capacities at the Orthodox Union, including a decade as a director of national programs for NCSY, the organization's youth movement. He also serves as educational correspondent for the website Jew in the City. He's the author of 9 books, including The God Book and Ask Rabbi Jack.
The center of Jewish faith and practice is not the synagogue, and it's not the yeshiva, which are the schools where we study Torah. It's the home. So those other things are important, and people should definitely avail themselves of them. But you can go to the best schools, and you can pray in the best houses of worship. But if you don't have the grounding at home, you're fighting an uphill battle. And we put a lot of emphasis on home and family. I mean, one of the most important nights of the year is Passover night, where we have a special meal called the Seder. This is not something that happens in the synagogue. This is something that happens in your house with your family. Hanukkah, where we light the menorah. Yes, we light it in the synagogue also, but that's incidental. The real, I just made air quotes even though it's a podcast, the real lighting, the one for which we give emphasis, is in our homes every night with our families. There's a tremendous emphasis on education. There's a tremendous emphasis on continuity. So yeah, some people don't have the benefit of a family where they practice these things, and they can certainly pursue them on their own, but as a culture, we're very into promoting the family unit and the continuity and the upbringing, and it's all about the kids.
You mentioned the Seder. I've heard adults who were not Jewish who were invited as guests go to a Seder, and then there are questions that are asked that the very youngest children, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, were answering, and they were so impressed that these young children knew how long the children of Israel, for instance, had been in the wilderness, or whatever the other questions were, from a very young age.
The emphasis of the Seder is very much on education. In fact, the word for Passover in Hebrew is Pesach, and that means two things. It means to pass over, hence the English term, but it also means a mouth that speaks. So telling over the Passover story is the entire point of the holiday. So at the Seder, there are the four questions that the youngest present asks, usually a child. If there are no children, then the youngest adult. So that's an important part of the Seder. And then the Seder talks about four sons, and it gives biblical verses to explain different ways, different approaches that we're supposed to transmit these ideas based on a child's personality. So if he's a particularly wise and insightful child, you use this approach. If he's a stubborn and obstinate child, you use that approach. So that's also in the text of the Seder, the four sons.
So I won't ask you which of the four you were, but...
A wise guy wasn't technically one of them. Wise son, yes. Wise guy, not as much. But King Solomon said, educate a child according to his way. That's really what we're all about. In fact, a lot of the customs that we have at the Seder, there's a green vegetable that we eat close to the beginning. There's some other things. There's a mix of nuts and wine and apples. So... The Talmud, when discussing these things, asks, why do we do that? And the answer to these questions is so the children should ask, because we want to open the door to questions so then we can take the opportunity to explain what happened in Egypt and the Exodus and the redemption that went along with it.
So that's such a strong tradition because it repeats. I'm just curious. So as young Jewish people go out into the world, so they're leaving their family home, they're likely still in touch with family and may even go back for those observances. But I guess there's a decision that you have to make. Will I carry this on in the household I'm establishing? I guess that's between you and your spouse. What was that like for you? Did that feel strange to you the first time? It's like, well, here we are in our own home. I guess it's time to light the Shabbat candles as they've been lit for so long.
My wife and I were both on the same page, and that's very important, not just in the Jewish community, but in general. If you marry someone with diametrically opposed politics, or if you're a very rabid non-smoker, you don't marry a smoker. If you're a very strong vegetarian, you don't marry the local butcher. So same thing with religion, and people... People tend to poo-poo this because the early 20s, when a lot of people are seriously dating and starting to look for spouses, is also the time in one's life when they tend to be their least religious. Since my wife and I had both been through this youth organization and were both inspired by it, we did aspire to the same type of lifestyle. So for us, that wasn't really a problem. But I always say it's not enough to be in the same place. You have to be going in the same direction. If you have two people who are in the same spot, religiously speaking, as well as politically and in other ways, but one of them is moving to the left and the other is moving to the right, then in 5 years or 10 years or however long it takes, they may find themselves no longer in the same spot. So yes, when one is moving out on their own, they have to decide what they're going to embrace and what they're going to pursue and what they may discard. And if you're doing that with somebody else, then these are conversations you can't take for granted. I know of mixed marriages, and only when they have kids do they start to worry about how they're going to raise them, because religion wasn't important to them when they were dating. And the life cycle events, when you start having funerals and things like that, it just brings people closer to their heritage. And it's a little late to have that conversation with your spouse then.
And it seems like a lot of people realize, oh, there are some things that made me who I am that were part of my faith tradition. How can I pass them on? In fact, can I pass them on without a faith tradition? What do you think about that?
So as far as being moral and one's character and one's personality, that's an inherent thing. Obviously, one can work on eradicating their bad traits and amplifying their good traits. But my family was not as religious when I was younger. And my sister, who was older, did not become religious like I did. But we had the same upbringing. We had the same parents. I channeled the morality that my mother instilled in me into theology, religion, becoming a rabbi. My sister became a cop, and she was a 9/11 first responder, and she worked in SVU, which has a lot more paperwork than on TV. So we both had a sense of morality, and we both wanted to do good things for the community. We just expressed it in different ways. So I don't think a lack of a religious tradition would stop someone from expressing who they are. But if you want to pass that forward, it obviously helps to have it. In my capacity, I have people in their 60s and 70s writing to me, starting now. And it's never too late. Rabbi Akiva, one of the greatest sages of the Talmud, didn't start studying Torah until he was 40 years old. And he went on to become a great scholar whose name is renowned to this day. So yes, it's easier to pay it forward if you're raised with it, but you can always go looking for it. And by the way, those who don't have it can still give it to their kids, again, by sending them to the right schools and participating in their synagogue. So even if the parents don't live it themselves, they can still expose their families to it.
What inspired you to work with young people that way? And are there things that give you hope about young people today in the Jewish tradition?
When I was in junior high school, they brought the youth group to the synagogue where we were members, and I became really involved with it. It spoke to me. It was an enlightening experience, and it became a major part of my identity. It was exposing me to my background, to my tradition, to my religion in a way that I had never encountered before. And even after I graduated high school, I remained involved. When I was in college, I worked as an advisor, the volunteers who work with the kids. And then even when I was a young adult, I was working in various capacities for the organization. So I would say I worked for about a decade as a volunteer doing things as an adult for the organization before a position was brought to my attention that someone said, hey, you should apply for this. So it was a passion for what that organization did, for what they did for me as a teen. My wife also was very much a product of this organization, NCSY. It's truly a life-changing experience, and we wanted to share that with other people.
What does the acronym stand for?
It used to stand for National Conference of Synagogue Youth, and they were, as in my case, based out of synagogues. But the model has changed over the years, and the kids are not being found in the synagogues like they used to. And what it stands for is more historic than anything else.
I'd love to talk about what you felt, what you recognized when you were first going with the youth group and became associated. That is an age where young people really need a sense of belonging, whatever their identity is. And that sounds like it's something you felt right away.
The teenage years are when people are really searching to figure out who they are. And they can be a lot of different things in a short span of time. They have to find what speaks to them. I was always interested in religion, and I was always interested in my own religion as well as other religions. But there's always this perception about the right wing, the most religious of any group, being somehow not fun-loving and out of touch. And really, this just put me in a position where I could see that the people who were living the religion day to day, not just once a week on the Sabbath or not just once a year on the high holidays, but every day are still down to earth, fun loving, friendly people, perfectly normal, except that they practice the religion more regularly than others. I've noticed this in other faiths as well. So it's just a bias that once you can get past, you can see things that from the outside are not apparent. And like I said, my wife, who I did not know yet, had the same experience, and we wanted to share that with others.
Yeah, I guess the appearance would be super straight-laced.
Yes.
If someone appears to be on the more religious end of things, the more observant end of things.
Right. And that's a big assumption. There are fun people who are very religious, and there are not so fun people who are not at all religious. It's a personality thing, not a religion thing.
Well, you were very lucky to have good, I think, youth leaders, and the current ones and the ones that you have been part of their experience have benefited, I think, from your good nature, it sounds like already.
I'm still in touch with some of them. It could be 30 years later. They can be principals of high schools, and yet, you know, we still have good relationships. It's a very bonding experience.
You mentioned your family not being particularly practicing as you were growing up, but it sounds like there was a Jewish identity there.
Oh, there absolutely was. There are different streams of Judaism. So there's Reform, Conservative, Orthodox, which most people are familiar with. There's Reconstructionist, there's Humanistic, there's others. They're generally perceived to be more religious, less religious, even though they actually disagree on some fundamental issues. But they're all Judaism. They're not different religions. So I was raised in a Reform household, but my parents had had more upbringing themselves. So they were among the most religious of the people in the Reform community. We kept kosher in the house. So we would go out and eat non-kosher food, but all of our dishes were kosher. We had separate dishes for meat and for milk, as kosher households do. When I was in maybe fifth grade, my parents had become more interested in the religion because of, I don't know if you're familiar with Lubavitch.
Chabad Lubavitch?
Yes. So they do a lot of outreach and help teach families about their religious heritage. So my parents had some friends who raised the boat, and it changed things a little bit in the house. We stopped eating non-kosher out, and our Sabbath observance became better than it was, but still not, you know, strictly what the Orthodox would do. But then when I was in eighth grade, as I mentioned, the youth group came to the synagogue, and I became more interested in Orthodoxy, and my parents were largely drawn behind in my wake. My sister, who by that point was in high school, as I mentioned, was, you know, not particularly interested. But my parents, definitely, my father started wearing the yarmulke after I did. So, and he worked in a public high school in Queens. So that's no small thing, you know, just one day to show up at work wearing a yarmulke.
Well, it is interesting how families influence each other. One of my grandfathers was a cattleman for years in Eastern Oregon, known as Honest Jake to his neighbors. And one day a man came to the ranch and said, "Jake, you sold me a sick calf and I want my money back. It died." Well, my grandpa knew the calf was healthy when he'd sold it, but he told the man, "I wouldn't want you to feel bad that I sold you a sick calf and lose a friend, so I'll pay you the money." My uncle, then a young man, was present and he was dumbfounded. But a week later, this man showed up at the house and returned the money. And he said, "Jake, I've been thinking about it, and I've decided that calf must have been healthy because I don't think you would sell me one that wasn't." So after the man left, my uncle turns to Grandpa and said, "Did you know he was change his mind?" And Grandpa said, "Well, I know his heart and that he's a good man deep down. He just needed some time to do the right thing." When my uncle told us this story years later, he had tears, appreciating both his dad's honesty, but also that his dad, my grandpa, had taught him to be patient with people and believe in their goodness. So I see the influence that families of faith have on each other. Rabbi Jack, are there things that you've discovered along the way about the Jewish tradition that really bring you joy? Particular holidays or observances or maybe daily or weekly things?
It's funny. There are a lot of people who say I'm spiritual but not religious. And I like to joke that I'm religious but not spiritual. My answers for the Q&A that I do for the various organizations, they're not the touchy-feely kind. They're very straightforward, very to the point, because that's just how I am. That's my personality. There are people who are definitely mystical, spiritual. Everything has, you know, a deep symbolic reason. You know, symbolism is great, but I don't believe most of the things we do were instituted for their symbolism. I believe that's largely an explanation after the fact. So I enjoy the study, which is a major part of being Jewish, in particular of being Orthodox. So there are people for whom, you know, doing acts of kindness is a major thing for them. That's what makes them feel it's all about. There are people for whom the Sabbath, that's what it's all about. We have very strict laws against gossip and slander. And there are people for whom encouraging others to forego those types of what we call lashon hara, evil speech, you know, for them, that's the thing. So the beautiful thing is there are so many different things that we all practice, but something different speaks to everyone else.
Hi, Stephen Cap Perry here, host of In Good Faith. Here's another podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts I hope you'll check out. What I love is real. You know that saying, real recognize real? That's Lisa on The Lisa Show. Lisa Valentine Clark is a comedian, she's a believer, a single mother, and on The Lisa Show podcast, you'll hear from the Council of Moms, a genius idea which is actually one of my favorite parts of her show, and you'll hear about the challenges of life, parenting, mental health questions, social issues. Yes, you'll hear from experts, but also from people discussing their where the rubber meets the road life experience. It's The Lisa Show, wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Good Faith. I'm speaking with Rabbi Jack from Jew in the City about Jewish families. Tell me about your journey and decision to become a rabbi.
It's not the same in Judaism, and specifically in Orthodoxy, as it is in some other religions. I imagine if one is Catholic and one goes to church, there's the priest at the altar, and that's the clergy. In Judaism, if you go to the synagogue, there's the rabbi, who's the guy at the pulpit, but there could also be half a dozen or more other rabbis scattered in the pews, and this one's a lawyer by trade, and that one's an accountant by trade, and this one's a plumber, because in the Orthodox community, with its emphasis on lifelong learning, it's kind of like getting a master's degree, which is not everybody does it, but it's hardly unheard of. So yeah, it's funny because I wasn't even working in this capacity when I started the rabbinic training. I was working as director of admissions for a small liberal arts college in New York. So it's not as if it had anything at all to do with my career. It was strictly a passion project.
So at some point, enough people asked you questions and then you had satisfying enough answers that you became Ask Rabbi Jack.
Yes. So it started when I was working for NCSY. I was director of national programs, and we started a webpage, Ask NCSY. And the idea was that teens would submit their questions and we would answer them. And I then started collecting them in pamphlets that we would give to the advisors at our training conferences so that they could see the way different questions are asked and how to address different types of questions. There's a lot you can get from the way the question is asked. You can tell, is the person asking sincerely? Are they being antagonistic? So actually, I then started using it as a training tool. And we started putting out some pamphlets that had common questions that kids ask. And this way, the advisors would have the answers. Because remember, the advisors are college kids. They're religious and they're practicing, but they're not yet generally learned. Not to say that I'm learned. I'm just more learned than they. So in any event, when I switched over from NCSY to other divisions in the Orthodox Union, I started getting a lot of questions referred to me by the people who receive them. In fact, a colleague of mine, I'll give her a shout out. Hi, Miriam. Typically sends me tons of questions that have nothing to do with my job. And I always say to her, in fact, I've stopped asking because I already know the answer, but I would always say to her, why did you send me this? It's nothing to do with my department. And she would always say, I like the way you answer it. So you know what? Everyone has a skill, and it's important to know what your skill is, to not have false modesty about it. It's also important to know what you're not good at. I can't sing, please don't ask me. But this I do fairly well, so...
Okay, so not a cantor in the making.
Absolutely not. You wouldn't want, that would be your punishment. And on Jew in the City, I answer questions. I've been doing that for a little over a decade now. Thank God, you know, I'm able to satisfy most people's questions on a variety of topics. This is not to say I know all the answers off the top of my head, but I know where to look.
One of the places people look for answer, of course, is in Scripture. So looking to the Torah, these are not stories about perfect families.
They are not.
And human families really struggling sometimes to hold it together or don't speak to each other for years. I'm thinking of Esau and Jacob at the time.
That's a very extreme case of a dysfunctional family, yes.
Yeah, but even Adam and Eve from the very beginning, as we read. Are there particular stories from anywhere in that set of Scripture that inspire you or that inspire youth that you've worked with or families that you work with?
I wouldn't say inspire so much as educate. Mm. Like, for example, in the book of Samuel.
Like maybe a warning.
Yes, a cautionary tale sometimes.
Yeah.
In the book of Samuel, King David has a son named Absalom, and he dotes on this child and spoils him absolutely rotten. And you would think that the child would grow up loving his father, worshiping at his feet, you know, just doing everything he can to support the one who really was so permissive with him, so lenient with him, gave him everything. And the opposite happened. Absalom went on to lead a coup and drive David from Jerusalem. And this, of course, King Solomon, as you know, says, you know, unfortunately, some people take this too literally, spare the rod and spoil the child. And that's a perfect example. You have to take a harder line with your kids than David did with Absalom. But a story where I think the person gets a bad rap is Jacob and Joseph.
Mm.
So in the famous story, Jacob gives his son Joseph a multicolored coat, and the brothers presumably are jealous of this, although in the text, it's not so clear that they're jealous of the coat. They're more upset by the dreams than the coat. But people interpret this, oh, Jacob showed favoritism, and that was the source. Think about the situation. Rachel, Joseph's mother, died giving birth to Benjamin. All the other brothers had mothers. Benjamin was a baby and never knew his mother. Joseph was the only one who had to live with the pain of losing his mother. So Jacob knew that Joseph needed a little extra loving care. And honestly, a brightly colored coat is small compensation for the loss of a parent.
Mm.
So when people like tell this story, Jacob always gets a bad rap for showing favoritism. No, I think Jacob should be praised for knowing that his children don't all need the same things. Where he fell short might have been perhaps in not communicating better to the brothers what was going on. But in fact, I can give you a real life example about that. My parents, in their will, left everything split down the middle, 50-50 between me and my sister, except that they also gave my sister their timeshare. And my mother told me up front, they said, we're leaving Jennifer the timeshare because when your kids were little, we paid for their preschool tuitions. See, now, I might have spent years agonizing, why did they favor my sister over me? Why did they, give her preferential treatment? Had my mother just not been upfront with me about it? And she was. So same thing, Jacob maybe could have communicated to the other sons a little bit better that Joseph needs a little extra. But beyond that, his actions were appropriate. So from these stories, I think we can learn great lessons. It's not a full parenting book, but there's plenty in there from which we can glean and base our own actions.
Finally, Rabbi Jack, what a pleasure to speak with you. You would just be a delightful person to have any conversation with, I think.
True. This is absolutely undeniably a fact.
I am wondering, what do you know now about the idea of God or the divine, having lived a few more decades, than you knew at the beginning when you were just discovering what a Jewish identity was?
For me, I think the one that speaks to me the most is the concept of prayer. When most people think of prayer, they think, oh Lord, please let me win the lottery. And that's not it at all. Prayer isn't about asking God for what we want. It's about praising God because he gives us so much. And when we do ask God for things in prayer, it's for his benefit as much as we're able to benefit God, in that, please give me a livelihood so that I can serve you better. Please give me good health so that I can perform your will. And this is why I can't speak for other religions, but we don't pray, please let me marry Betty Sue, or please, get me a job with the Oakland Raiders. We say, God, please help me find the one that you have determined is the best match for me. God, please help me earn a living in a way that you have determined is appropriate. So that's the thing. We trust that God has everything under control. We thank him. We do ask him for things, but only in the context of making us better. And people look at prayer as an obligation, something they have to do. It's an opportunity. Imagine if you had a meeting with the president for half an hour every morning. He may not always give you everything you want, but the fact that he's giving you the time and taking you seriously and wants to see you again tomorrow is a tremendous thing. That alone is worth the trip. So I think for me, the thing that became recontextualized the most is the idea of prayer. And of course, there are many other things, but to me, that's the biggie.
That's a beautiful example. And am I correct in understanding that even the days of mourning, Kaddish, that even that is not so much a prayer of comfort as a prayer of praise?
Yes. Kaddish is a prayer that is recited when someone's in mourning, but it's recited on other occasions as well. And we recognize that all things come from God. Things that we're happy about come from God, and things that are painful come from God. Mm. And it's natural for people to question when bad things happen. But the reality is, when somebody dies younger than you think they should have, people complain, oh, he was so young, it's not fair. But I never saw anyone who lost a grandparent say, well, he was old, it was time, it was fair. It's always painful. Mm. Life includes aspects of pain, but we always thank God because we know that we don't have the big picture. Only he has the big picture. And we know that he can see the story from start to finish, which we can only see the page we're on right now. And we praise him in all ways. Like it says in Job, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. People forget the end of that verse, which is now praise God.
Many thanks to Rabbi Jack Abramowitz for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander, Heidi Hansen, and James Sturtevant. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Subscribe to our YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith. Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. In our BYU Radio family of podcasts, I've got to tell you about an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. Are you ready to immerse yourself in the awe-inspiring world of nature? That's what Constant Wonder does. Host Marcus Smith brings us on trips and conversations with people whose lives have been touched by the beauty of the earth and exploring its mysteries. If you crave some adventure and you want to travel the earth, but it's hard to fit into your schedule, Do what I do and listen to Constant Wonder, riveting conversation with individuals whose lives have been impacted and changed by their explorations of the Earth's beauty and its mysteries. Constant Wonder, wherever you get your podcasts.